2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 152, The Magnificent Cause of Being, a paper presented by Harley Welker with a response by Karen Marguerite Maloney.
Mosquito repellent every night. The kitchen was tacked on the back, a lean-to affair with a roof of corrugated plastic that wasn't sealed at all. Roaches and spiders were always crawling in through any number of holes. We soon set about learning our way around the area, meeting the local church members and looking for investigators. Junction itself was easy to navigate. The chapel was a mere 3-minute bike ride from our house. The real challenge was that we had 3 other towns, Nanto and Taotuan, which were a few miles away, and Puli, 40 miles up the mountain, in our district. We spent a lot of time gaping at the beauty of our new home. Zhongxin Xinsuan, or Middle Righteous New Village, was near the middle of the island and relatively new and had been laid out to resemble a western town with wide tree-lined streets and 2-story homes with small gardens. Most of its residents were from the mainland, people who had come over after World War II as Chiang Kai-shek. It was one of the more noticeably upper-middle-class places on the island, populated in no small part by retired government officials and friends of powerful people. There were also a fair number of farmers. Junction was surrounded by rice paddies, banana plantations, and grapevines. The fields made me homesick. This just seems like it's too close to my face. There. Because it was a small town with less light or air pollution, and because it was almost the center of the island and got less fog, the sky was clearer and darker than on the coast. I loved being able to see the stars again. To the north was the big mountain where Sun Moon Lake, a popular honeymoon resort, was located. Not far from the lake was Puli, the center of the island and the island's primary source of passion fruit. The bus ride to Puli lasted an hour. The first half of the ride was dull, but at some point you seemed to have entered paradise and found yourself ascending through marble gorges carved by centuries of water. In some places, terraces and steps had been hewn into the marble. There were waterfalls, banana trees and palms, and flowering trailing vines that had overgrown those terraces cut 1,000 years ago. You could see only 3 colors, white rock, green foliage, and blue sky and water, a delicate jungle that took your breath away. As the only female missionaries in the district, Sister Steele and I had to go to church in Puli every Sunday in case the missionaries there found any single women investigators. And before I left Zhongxin for good, the round-trip bus ride to Puli had become my favorite event of the week. I could speak to no one. I could sit by a window and look at it. I was Steele's first American companion. During her 6 months on island, she had worked only with Chinese companions. For 2 months, she had been the only American in an apartment of 4 people. From both necessity and desire, she spoke better Chinese and read far more characters than I. But I'd been a missionary 2 months longer, and so was senior companion. I had wished more than once that Steele and I would get to be companions. I thought that because we were already friends after the 4 months we spent as roommates in Tainan, working together would be that much more enjoyable and productive, like a wonderful week I spent on trade-offs with a DL and his companion when my trainer went home and I was left without a companion. I knew Sister Steele and I had differences in our approaches to missionary work, but I underestimated how important those differences would become. The investigator pool Sister Steele and I inherited from the 2 previous sisters was neither big nor strong, mostly 14 and 15-year-old girls whom, I thought, had not been well taught. Their ideas about the gospel struck me as trite, and it was hard to have a serious conversation with them about anything. They were terrified of the elders, one of whom was over 6 feet tall, and spent a lot of time avoiding them. "That tall one is like the big bad wolf," one of the girls said. "He could bite off my head and still have room inside his mouth to laugh." Zhongxin had been the site of some spectacular failures and difficulties, the details of which I could never discover. President Gardner had closed it for several months, then reopened it when I first arrived on island. It had then seen such rapid success that a chapel had been built. The member coordinator was helpful and kind when she wanted to be, and full of excuses when she didn't. She did give us many phone numbers for recently baptized members who no longer attended church. I spent a lot of time on the phone at the chapel trying to get in touch with the people we were supposed to be teaching. We were introduced right away to the Joe family, a couple in their early 30s with a 7-year-old son known as Spike. They had been members for about 6 months, one of the families baptized in the early burst of success. They fed us lunch our first Wednesday there and told us to drop by often. That first week in Zhongxin was the best week I had there, I wrote. This week has been an exercise in deja vu. From conversations with Steele to scenes on the street, I've been here before. I've dreamed this place. Really, I've seen it. It's both scary and comforting. I'm supposed to be here, but what am I supposed to do? I managed to feel basically happy and relatively successful. That's in quotes. That was my mission president was always asking me, are you happy? Are you happy? I guess so. Anyway. Once in a discussion with four young women, I became very impassioned as I talked about why I had decided to come on a mission and what I wanted to accomplish. Sister Steele said to me afterwards, it wasn't until you started missing a tone here or there when we'd said the closing prayer and you had to repeat yourself a bit that I realized that your Chinese during your testimony was almost flawless. But Sister Steele did not like being junior companion, and she especially did not like being my junior companion. I was not ambitious enough for her, and she hated listening to my inferior Chinese. She grew more and more impatient. Towards the end of the week, we tried to find an address we'd been given for Mrs. Tsai. It didn't seem to exist. We located the street, but not the number we needed. I knocked on a door near where the address should have been. A woman answered. Hi, I said. We're looking for Mrs. Tsai. We were told she lives around here, I said, and showed the woman the address as it was written. Sister Steele stood close behind me. We're named Bai, the woman said. Does anyone named Tsai live around here, I asked. Didn't you understand what she meant, Sister Steele interrupted, clearly angry. Yes, I said. She told me their surname is Bai. No, she didn't, Steele said. She didn't mean we're named Bai. She meant we believe in ancestor worship. This wasn't an unreasonable interpretation. We're named Bai sounds like woman Xing Bai, and we believe in ancestor worship sounds like woman Xing Bai Bai. I don't think so, I said. Ask her name, she said curtly. What's your surname, I asked the woman. Her mouth tightened in annoyance. I already told you. We're named Bai. I looked at Sister Steele and smiled. She put her face down, but not before I saw tears of frustration welling in her eyes. Sorry to bother you, I said to the woman. Let's go, I said to Sister Steele. When we were on the street again, I asked, what's wrong? You know, I'd like it if we did this together, she said. I should have been part of that conversation, too. Okay, I said. I don't need to do all the talking. You know that. I need your help. Just don't get mad at me like that. But I managed to make her angry all the time, no matter what I did. One of the first people we met was Chun Mama. Chun Mama never spoke in the first person. When you ask how she was, she would sigh hard and say, Chun Mama is not good, which was probably true because her husband had run off with her younger sister and refused to pay child support. Chun Mama had been a Christian for 5 months when we met her, but she had been making Christmas ornaments for years. Sometimes we would help her, gluing fake hair on toy soldiers or wrapping scarves around snowmen's necks before slapping a Made in Taiwan sticker on the bottom and putting the whole thing in a cellophane bag. Our first Saturday night in Zhongxin, Steele and I attended a church activity that doubled as a birthday party for two of Chun Mama's teenage daughters, and we took two investigators in tow. Steele had made sure that a lesson would be given at the activity, but the lesson presented did not meet with her satisfaction. It was too general, too brief. But there was a lot of good food, and people seemed to have fun. I myself was glad we met everyone in a setting less formal than sacrament meeting, but Steele wasn't pleased by the number and devotion of the local members, and she wasn't pleased that I wasn't more bothered. A discussion of the day, prefaced by her comment, I need a standard around here, led to a fight that lasted from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. We have a standard, I said. I mean, these people can't even use our first names. Are you saying we should be even more formal and rigid? Don't patronize me, she snapped. I'm honestly asking, I said. I don't know what you mean. The members don't do things right. We not only have to teach them the gospel, we have to teach them how to follow the rules. I mean, the church isn't just some social organization. It's not just some excuse to have parties. People have to take their spirituality seriously. It's Saturday night, I said. Is it so awful to have a party on Saturday night? We haven't been to sacrament meeting yet. Maybe it will be great. Can't you wait until tomorrow to get all mad because they're not spiritual enough? Now you're being snide, she said, then added, do you want to test the Lord? You know I hate that stuff, I said. No, I don't want to test him. Don't you patronize me and don't try to set me up. She tried again. What have you sacrificed to come here? I began counting on my fingers, unfurling my hand with a flourish each time I added an item. The right to read whatever I want. French. I loved French and I worked so hard to learn it, but now it's so rusty that it takes me forever to write a single sentence. Spending time with my family. School. Writing. And, I paused dramatically, a heck of a lot of sleep. She rolled her eyes. Okay, what do you want the result of your sacrifices to be? What do you want to give your investigators? Oh, like I can give them anything, I said, except maybe a part of myself. I can't give anyone a belief in God, and you know it. All right, then, what do you want your investigators to gain as a result of meeting the church? I knew she was frustrated with me, but I didn't want to capitulate, didn't want to answer her questions as if I had no personal stake in the situation, as if the only interests to consider were those of the people we taught, as if there was only one way to consider the interests of the people we taught. "More peace of mind than I have," I replied, which she wanted explained, so I said, "I want the people I teach to feel that no matter what, no matter how actively involved in the church they are, no matter how righteous they are or not, they can still go to God and ask Him for comfort and understanding and believe they'll get it." She threw up her hands. "We've got to aim higher than that. That's not enough." "I think it's a pretty tall order," I said. "If you had lived without that belief for a long time, you might think it was a big deal, too." "You don't have that?" she asked. "No," I said. For the first 2 hours, the fight centered not on our relationship, but on what can we do for the church in Taiwan. Nothing, not nothing. Everything, not everything. Something, yeah, something. How much was something? What did I want to help my investigators achieve? We went over it and over it. I kept stressing that ultimately what happened to the people I taught was their responsibility, not mine. She kept shaking her head. Around midnight, she said, "I just feel like you're not as committed to the church as you should be." I looked away. "Well," she said. I paused. "I have no imagination now." "You have no imagination now? What does that mean?" "I had one once, I know. I don't remember what I felt like, but I remember it didn't feel like this. Didn't feel empty and stupid in two languages. I can't speak Chinese on any kind of level that lets me explain what matters most to me. I hate it. But I can't write in English anymore, either. I can't communicate anything that matters to me anymore." "How did this happen?" "I don't know," I said. "Kaohsiung was so awful, so awful. I put a cork on everything inside me, all the things that it hurt so much not to be able to express, whether it was mission rules or a lack of fluency or Elfer's disapproval that made me mute. Now I'm afraid all those things are gone." "They're not gone," she said. "They feel gone. And anyway, if they're not gone, maybe they should be. In the temple, I promised to devote my time, energy, worldly possessions, and my talent to the building up of the kingdom of God on earth, and I hate it." I shook my head. "Why does God need everything? My time and energy and worldly possessions? No biggie. But my talent? Well, I want it. I want to write poetry about life, not about gospel topics." "Why do you think they're different?" "I don't think they're different." "They're different. Remember our talks about Eliot and Shakespeare? How different is Othello or The Wasteland from a Sunday school manual?" She didn't say anything, just took my hand. "Don't," I said. "I know you're trying to make me feel better, but I also know I sound like a spoiled brat, and I hate that too." I sniffed back tears. "I mean, it's not like I think anything I wrote would be as good as Othello or The Wasteland or Hamlet or whatever. But at least before I could try to write something. Now I can't do anything. Something's just dead. That's why I hate the church. It killed my imagination. And for what? These dumb sacrifices don't even seem to lead anywhere. Look how few Mormons there are anyway." "That's why we have to work harder," she said. "I know," I sighed. "I know, I know." "Can I hug you?" she asked. "I have to go to the bathroom. You can hug me when I get back." "I'll hug you now," she said, "and then I'll hug you when you get back, too." But somehow we just sat there and kept talking. For 4 hours, our conversation went on that night, circling again and again on how little she thought I understood true righteousness, how skeptical I'd become of the whole enterprise of missionary work, how broken I felt, how much Sister Steele loved and worried about me, until finally my bladder was about to burst and I excused myself to use the upstairs toilet, the little closet on the back balcony. Truly, at 2 a.m., it was peaceful to sit with the door open and survey the night. Instead of going inside after I finished peeing, I stood and listened to the frogs in the dark and tried to hear God above or below the croaking. I had told Sister Steele that I wanted the people I taught to feel that no matter how actively involved they were in the church, no matter how righteous they were, they could still go to God for comfort and understanding and believe they'd get that because I lacked it. I got no comfort from him that night. I felt I sensed his awareness of me, and it seemed that he wasn't angry but indifferent. So that's it, I thought. It's not that there's nothing out there. It's that I'm nothing. I had read intellectual discussions of the insignificance of humanity as a whole, as well of each of its individual members, but that was before I had acquired a deep emotional knowledge of what it meant to be nothing, of what it meant to know that the struggle that was so overwhelmingly difficult and important for me was actually unworthy of concern, that any pain or happiness I might feel simply didn't matter because I didn't matter. A profound, unspeakable shame at my very existence on this planet choked me. I felt the few resources I had left to me had been put on display before me so that I could see how truly paltry and inadequate they were for the monumental task I had ahead of me, which was simply to continue to do for 8 more months what I had already been doing for 10. As stuck as I had felt in Kaohsiung, I felt even more caged in Zhongxing. I stayed on the balcony in my nightgown, and for a good 15 minutes I cried, not just tears running down my face, but noisy, gasping, hiccupy sobs that probably woke the neighbors and certainly alarmed Sister Steele. I didn't apologize or offer an explanation when I went back into bed. Space break. Zhongxin's meeting were held Sunday morning. The branch was extremely small, about 30 or 40 members. After lunch, Steele and I went to Puli to attend their afternoon meetings. The branch in Puli was tiny, only a dozen members. Everyone in both branches seemed unaccountably anxious, but the branch in Puli, small as it was, seemed better organized and administered. On P-Day, we had a long companionship inventory at Steele's request, rehashing stuff we talked about on Saturday night. I wrote a few letters, then started a tape for my friend Martha. Martha was a poet in Tucson who sent me fantastic care packages full of magazines, earrings, sweets, and music. Her letters were terrific, newsy and provocative, provided I could read them. She always used flimsy, messy aerograms, and her handwriting was awful. Deciphering a single page could take an hour. I had received two letters from her a few days earlier and didn't feel like working through on paper everything I wanted to tell her. Instead, I went outside on the balcony, sat on the hip-high wall, and made a tape. 90 minutes of Taiwan's unusual sounds and my nasal sighs and whines. You guys already know this part, but I wrote this for a non-member audience, so just bear with me for the next few sentences. Mormons believe that every single human being who has ever lived must be given the opportunity to accept the true church and be baptized, and that's why they aggressively pursue missionary work to convert the living and do genealogy to find the names of everyone who was ever born so that baptisms can be performed for the dead, as the Apostle Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 15. It's staggeringly ambitious and more generous than some plans of salvation, but still, the logic has always struck me as flawed. In Mormon scripture, God tells Moses, "For this is my work and my glory, to bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man." In the MTC, we were shown a pie graph charting the number of adherents of all the world's religions. It was supposed to underscore how pressing it was that we get busy and convert the rest of the world, but I remember staring at it, thinking about the huge wedge of humanity on the chart that was Hindu, the huge wedge that was Buddhist, the smaller wedge that was Christian, and the tiny, tiny wedge that was Mormon. In 1985, about 9 million of the Earth's 5 billion inhabitants were Mormon. I thought, for someone who is supposed to be omnipotent, God isn't meeting with much success in his work and his glory. Surely if it really mattered to him that the whole world hear the message of Mormonism, he would work harder to get it out there. The church had only been around for a little more than 150 years. If he were really anxious to offer the truth to every last human being who ever drew breath on this planet, why would he wait so long to reveal it? I felt there were several logical conclusions one could draw from this state of affairs. First, either God wasn't omnipotent, or he didn't really care about us, or the church wasn't really as necessary to salvation as its adherents like to claim, or perhaps all of those things were true. When I had explained this to Sister Steele Saturday night, she began to worry that I was on the verge of apostasy. I sat on the balcony, Martha's two aerograms in one hand, my tape recorder in the other, and worked out an analogy to explain my logic. God, it seemed to me, was like a basketball coach who put the third string in for the first 3.5 quarters of a championship game, and then, when his team was trailing by 120 points, he put in the first string and told them, "Hey, you guys, let's win this game." As I juggled the tape recorder and Martha's letters, I dropped one of the aerograms. The wind caught it briefly. The aerogram fluttered and rose, then fell smack in the center of the slanted kitchen roof of the house to the east, about 15 feet where I was sitting. 15 feet from where I was sitting. "Shoot," I moaned, still talking into the tape recorder. "I just dropped your letter. Now I'm going to have to climb. I can't climb down and get it. I'll have to find some way to fish it off the roof." I sighed hard. "Bother. I don't know, Martha. I'm trying so hard not to think about the things that make me unhappy that it's like I can't think at all anymore. I've lost my imagination. I can't lie or pretend anymore. It's weird. I come home every night and I sit and I look at these scratches on the wall and the paint above my desk, and that's what they are. Scratch marks on the wall above my desk in this ugly house in Taiwan. I can't make them into anything else. The way you look at clouds and pretend you see animals. You remember what John said the first rule of poetry is? You learn to lie. And I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. If I went home today, I couldn't write anything, and it breaks my heart." Another sigh. But that's what the Lord wants. He wants a broken spirit and a contrite heart. Or is it a broken heart and a contrite spirit? Anyway, I'm going to go figure out some way to get your letter off the roof, I said, and stop the tape. I told Sister Steele, who was writing letters in the bedroom, what had happened. She came out and helped me throw a few Coke cans and plastic cups at the letter, trying to knock it off the roof. No luck. She pursed her mouth, appraised the letter lying limply out of reach, then said, "You know, it wouldn't be that hard to just climb down and pick it up." "You've got to be kidding," I said. "No," she said. "I could hold on to the wall until I got to where the letter is, then just walk out and get it." "But what if you slipped off the roof?" I asked. "I don't think this plastic stuff is that slick, and besides, it's only about 8 feet down, and the ground is really soft and muddy." I hesitated, beguiled by the temptation, then said, "Well, I'll do it. After all, it's my letter," hitched up my skirt, and climbed over the wall to stand on the roof. As soon as I was on the other side of the wall, I began to think maybe it wasn't such a good idea. "Be careful," Sister Steele said. I didn't answer, just started snaking along the outside of the balcony to the spot above the letter. I didn't want to let go of the wall. "Okay," I finally said. The letter was about 3 feet below me. "I'd feel a lot better if it were me out there instead of you," Sister Steele said. I smiled at her and stepped out to retrieve the letter. "That's because you know I'm..." The next word was going to be clumsy. I didn't know this until later, but what had supported my weight was a metal bar right under where I was walking, put there so there'd be something to affix the sections of plastic roofing to. As soon as I wasn't standing on that, I dropped right through the roof. I was lucky. I fell just in front of the sink, not in the sink, not in on the refrigerator or on the stove. Also, there was no one in the kitchen, so I didn't land on anybody and injure them, too. The worst thing would have been if the woman had been cooking dinner and I'd landed in the wok. No doubt I would have gotten a few third-degree burns and killed or crippled her. As it was, I landed on my butt on the floor. I didn't manage to get my letter, but I managed to whack my head, my back, and my shoulder good and hard against the sink. My ears rang. My eyes didn't want to focus. My back hurt. All the air was knocked out of me, and as soon as I tried to inhale, I knew I'd cracked a rib, knew it though I'd never had a broken bone before. I waited for the dust to settle, then started yelling, "Wei!" which is what you say in Chinese to greet someone you can't see, like on the phone. The woman who lived there was upstairs and kept shouting back, "Shema Shur," which means, "What is it?" I didn't feel like explaining. As my head cleared, I noticed more about my condition. Somehow I'd knocked a few bottles of pickled bamboo, one of my least favorite vegetables, off the sideboard, and the contents had gone everywhere, plus my legs were cut and bleeding from the shards of broken glass. "Please come downstairs," I begged again and again, but it took a few minutes of pleading before I could convince her to come see for herself the white woman who had dropped in. It might have been Sister Steele's ringing the doorbell repeatedly that compelled my neighbor to leave off whatever she was doing upstairs. I don't exactly remember. I do remember assuring her that she could call someone to fix the roof and that my mission president would pay for the repairs. I apologized about a billion times. She was very polite while I sat there on her floor, cross-eyed and crying. She and Sister Steele helped me stand. Steele walked me back to our house, up the stairs, and put me to bed, then went to the payphone around the corner to call President Gardner. I was dazed and in pain and absolutely mortified with shame. I'd never done anything so silly before in my life. I began worrying about how to tell my parents. After a few minutes, Sister Steele returned and told me that President Gardner and his wife were driving down from Taichung and would arrive within the hour. "What else did he say?" I asked. "Nothing," she said. "Did he say I was an idiot?" "No." "No," I said. "He wouldn't say it. He probably thought it, though." To calm myself down, I had Sister Steele hand me my tape recorder so I could narrate events for Martha. I turned it on and said in a tearful, breathless voice, "Well, I'm lying in bed now. I think I've got a broken rib. I fell through the neighbor's kitchen roof and I didn't even get any out. Gee, if I'd gotten the letter, it would have been worth it after all. But I didn't and I can't breathe." It made quite a comic moment on the tape, coming as it did immediately after, "I'm going to go figure out some way to get your letter off the roof." At one point, Sister Steele left the room. Alone with my tape recorder, I tearily told Martha, so much for the conversation I was having. I guess the fact that I didn't land on my head proves that God loves me a little bit. I guess having urges to write that I can't fulfill is better than being dead. The first thing President Gardner did when he and Sister Gardner arrived was to take a broom, stand on the ground below the roof, brush my letter down, then simply pick it up off the earth. I was grateful to have it retrieved, but the obviousness and successfulness of that move made me feel even stupider. The Gardner suggested we pack a suitcase and stay at least one night at their house. Sister Steele and I had a few appointments scheduled for that evening. She called and canceled them. I was horribly embarrassed that we disappeared only a week after we had arrived. The Gardners drove me to the emergency room of the Taichung Hospital. One of the most common modes of transportation in Taiwan was the motorcycle, and nobody wore helmets. Most people who ended up in emergency rooms were traffic accident victims carrying missing half their faces and an arm or a leg. I, on the other hand, walked in. This convinced the attendant that nothing was wrong with me. When I told him I was certain I had broken a rib, figuring out the Chinese vocabulary for that, by the way, was a challenge, he pulled up my shirt, looked at my back, and said, "That's impossible. You're not bleeding." I cursed him and demanded x-rays, then added that something seemed to be wrong with my ears as well. Glancing at my head, he rolled his eyes and said, "Lady, there's no blood." "Inside my ears, you fool," I hissed. When he couldn't persuade me to go home, since there was, after all, nothing wrong with me, he assented to my seeing a doctor, who checked my head and said I had a mild concussion, then ordered some x-rays so we could all see that, sure enough, my eighth rib on my right side was cracked neatly in two. That's it. Thank you.
Karen Marguerite Maloney is a professor of English at Weber State and teaches English and creative writing and is a former missionary herself to Austria. She will be commenting on Holly's paper.
It wasn't Austria. It wasn't a real mission, but I'll talk about that in a second. Australia. On the art of rib repair. My first teaching position was as a deputy librarian at Keringle High School in an Australian town 30 miles from Melbourne. I lived with a talented, energetic family whom I adored. And as their adopted daughter for the interim, I found myself immediately at the center of the lively Frankston ward and was soon set apart to serve with the Smyberts as a special state missionary family to whom the real missionaries could bring their investigators for evenings of warm fellowship and gentle proselyting. This calling was anything but onerous. I loved our missionary evenings, and I only went tracting once or twice. The duration of my service, however, was uncharacteristically short. A mere 5.5 months into my new Australian life, the phone rang early one morning in the Smybert home, and my aunt summoned me home to California. Though my father's leukemia had been in remission when I accepted the Australian teaching assignment, it had now, she told me, vigorously reasserted itself. Several hours later, I boarded a plane for Los Angeles, and 4 months later, my father quietly died. The following February, though my mother would have preferred that I stay, I flew back to Australia to finish my teaching contract and a host of other things I felt unfinished about. By this time, though, my room in the Smybert home had been reclaimed by their own daughter, Lee, recently home from a mission to Queensland, and so I moved in with another family in the ward and concentrated my missionary efforts on Denise, today an active church member living near Sydney, then a delightful high school student who liked to seek me out in the library at lunch and after school to ask me questions. Not long, however, after my re-entry into Australian life, the new bishop called me in and asked me to consider going on a full-time mission. I was taken aback. Though I loved living in Australia, had in fact resigned a teaching position in California to return to Frankston, the thought of leaving for a mission from Australia was very unappealing. Not only would it prolong my absence from home, because as happy as I was in Australia, I was clear that home was in the States, but the regimented, difficult life of a real missionary would contrast sharply with the freedom, the fun, and the status I was enjoying as a curious, independent young American woman with the guts to move, even if temporarily, so far from home. Gone would be my holiday adventures within Australia, my new friendships, my teaching of literature to that bright fifth form class, my plans to travel through Southeast Asia on my way home, not to mention taking me off the relationship market for 18 months. And at 25, I would be older even than the other sister missionaries in the field. It wasn't a difficult decision, really. I may have struggled to do my best to consider the possibility, after all my bishop had suggested it, but there was nothing particularly attractive to me in the notion of serving a formal mission. In fact, there never really had been. I think I knew it would be hard, unglamorous, and lonely. It would not be fun. I think I also knew somehow what Holly Welker learned in Taiwan. Serving a mission would not require nor rely to any significant degree on imagination. When my brother and I were growing up, working on various school projects or entering contests, my mother consistently advised, "Use your imagination. Be original." It was an admonition that always encouraged me to try something new, to stretch against my limits. Today, I cannot even imagine what life would be like without the light of imagination. It is intertwined with everything I do. But I can imagine, thanks to the beautifully written chapter Holly has just read to us from her forthcoming book, what it must be like to feel duty-bound to leave the imaginative life behind so as to serve an honorable full-time mission for the church. I can also now imagine my feelings of despair, were I to believe that such a sacrifice had destroyed my imaginative capacity, perhaps irrevocably. Clearly, Holly is a gifted writer, but in writing of such painful personal experiences, not in a private journal, but in published form, she has been especially brave. One suspects that for her, as for so many other writers attempting to come to terms with traumatic events, a primary motivation was catharsis. If that is so, and I would be shocked if it weren't, I for one hope that writing her book produced profound catharsis. For this chapter makes it very clear how hard, unglamorous, and lonely were her months as a missionary in Taiwan. How immensely rewarding it must feel to turn this pain into a form of literature with roots as old as St. Augustine's Confessions and marked by so many memorable moments. Consider, for example, such fine renderings as that mosquito-infested missionary row house, an obsessively private missionary companion, and the clash of dialogue and wills between two very different women. Indisputably, Holly has keen powers of observation. She also has a way with metaphor. I'm thinking of the Edenic overtones in her description of the Taiwanese countryside. Indeed, at some point you seem to have entered paradise, Holly tells us about our trip to Puli, the source of the island's passion fruit. Later, beguiled by temptation, she begins snaking along the outside of the balcony until she fell. And very dramatically, we might add. So many people struggle intensely in a variety of ways during their missions, but very few are gifted enough to turn those struggles into art. Holly is also clearly a strong-willed, very independent woman. Though she is younger than my own contemporaries who served missions, she has given me a window into the 18 months that Raimi, Lee, Helen, Shirley, and Bonnie, for example, consecrated to the Lord. I read Holly's essay and found myself wondering about these friends of mine who chose to serve missions at a time when it was far less acceptable for women to do so than it is today. I clearly remember the jokes to which Raimi was subjected by her male friends when she talked about her missionary plans in the honors reading room at BYU. As I see it, then, my five girlfriends were especially strong and unusual to pursue missions during the 1970s, and they remain feisty and unusual to this day. Petite, brilliant Raimi had her heart set on two things when I knew her at BYU, serving a mission and law school. She served a mission in Uruguay, set about preparing for law school after she came home, and then married a Yale lawyer instead. In the last family photo she sent me, she looked as petite and beautiful as ever, surrounded as she was by at least 10 children. She remains utterly dedicated to the church, as does Lee Smybert, the feisty, daring daughter of the family with whom I lived in Australia. Lee is divorced, a self-described, though exaggeratedly so, weather-beaten Aussie, and the dedicated mother of four musicians whose professional performances she manages with aplomb. With equivalent gusto, she is also happy to take on her stake president regarding the raucous music, not up to church standards, played at youth dances in her stake. Helen, Shirley, and Bonnie, on the other hand, have left the church, all within the fairly recent past. Helen is a superb perinatal nurse who is surprised to discover love with another woman. Shirley is an overworked pharmacist, compassionate and insightful, who does a mean tarot card reading. And Bonnie is an enthusiastic sociology professor with a very complicated love life. All three have explored what might be called alternate spiritual paths, though only Shirley has formally aligned herself with another religion, Buddhism. In preparing to respond to Holly's essay today, I thought a lot about these friends of mine and engaged in some intriguing email and conversation with them regarding their missionary experiences. I find myself wondering whether any of the same qualities that led these strong women, Holly included, to serve missions also led them to leave the church. Or, as in the case of Raimi and Lee, I find myself pondering what it is that has kept them in. I'm already looking forward to a future Sunstone panel made up of returned baby boomer sister missionaries who might answer some of these questions for us all. In the meantime, though, we have Holly's carefully crafted memoir to guide us. The chapter we've been read today, of course, is only an installment in a much longer story. The abstract in the program led me to expect a more self-contained essay, one which served perhaps as an overall summary of her forthcoming book, complete with some formal conclusions. Instead, we've had our appetites whetted today to unravel the full metaphor of expulsion from paradise and the subsequent creation of a new woman. We're going to have to buy and read Holly's book, and the quality of her reading today makes it highly likely that we shall.
We'll go ahead and open up for questions, and I'm going to remove the mic so that we can give it to Holly and Karen to comment and have anybody's comments and questions spoken into the microphone. And my apologies, Karen, for so grossly misstating your credentials.
Gee, having to come up here makes this seem so much more profound. What made you decide to go on a mission, Holly, and where are you with the church today? I just read your Sunstone piece yesterday, so...
I decided to go on a mission because my family told me it would be okay if I left. I at age 20, I had pretty much decided the church wasn't for me. I informed my parents of this. They were very sad, but they said, "We always raised you to do what you thought was best. We'll love you no matter what." And I couldn't bear to break their hearts. And I thought, A mission will solve all my problems. A mission will make it easy for me to stay in the church. And I was wrong. But I have not. My mother made me promise that I would not have my name removed from the records of the church, so I'm still officially a member. But I have not attended church as a practicing Mormon since 1989. So. 3 years. 3 years after I got home, I quit going to church and wearing my garments. I lived with my parents for about 6 months after I got home. Then in 1991, I went to Shanghai, got really sick, came home, lived with my parents again for a year. Right now, I finished a PhD. I finished school in May, and right now I live a block from my parents. I'm still, you know, a huge disappointment to them, but they've made good. They put up with me no matter what. So they're actually really cool people, and I'm very lucky. So yes. Taught English
for
about 5 months. It was supposed to be a year. I got sick. 1991. Chris.
Okay, the memoir is going to be published by Signature.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about experiences you may have had sharing it with other kinds of publishers or any feedback you might have gotten?
Chris mentioned that this is forthcoming from Signature, but he wanted to know about my experiences sharing it with other agents and publishers. Every time I sent a query letter to an agent, I don't know if anybody knows how you go about publishing a book. In the secular world, you write query letters. You say, "I've written this book. Would you like to look at it?" And they'll write back and say yes or no, and then you send them either the whole thing or a few sample chapters. They read it. They usually take about 7 million months or 6 months, which seems like 7 million, and then they write back and they say yes or no. Every agent I queried, every editor I talked to wanted to see it. They all said no. They said they thought it would be too hard to publish, too hard to make any money off of, or they said they just didn't quite get it. That I got that quite a bit, even though I worked pretty darn hard to write it for a secular mainstream audience. Signature was very gracious, very receptive, very excited as soon as I gave it to them. And the fact that that they were so cool just convinced me that they would be the ones that could probably market it most effectively. So.
Are you going to do any rewriting?
Oh, I already have. I figure Mormons can stand to read a few sentences here and there explaining their theology. Yes?
I was one of the readers for Signature, and it was an electrifying experience.
Thank you. Thank you very, very, very much.
She,
it wasn't a question. She just told me that she, yeah, she just said she was one of the Signature readers and that it was an electrifying book. I'm very happy. Thank you. Yes?
Why do you think they didn't get it?
I wrote it crappy? I don't know. It's a hard thing to talk about, and I have looked for models in writing the book. I have found some interesting models. One of the most important books for me as I wrote it was Black Boy by Richard Wright. That book, when it was first published, the second half was truncated, but it's about the second half, which was later published, is about his experiences with the Communist Party and how he felt that the Communist Party had the potential to save the world, but that he said it's a good thing these people don't have any real power because they would kill me. Once he left the party, and his experiences leaving the Communist Party felt very much like my experiences leaving the church. It's just gut wrenching. It's hard. Leaving the church was the hardest thing I ever did. Then a book I discovered just a few months ago, which has become one of my favorite books, is called Through the Narrow Gate by a woman named Karen Armstrong, who was a cloistered nun in England in the 1960s for 7 years. She went in 62 and came out in 69. She missed the Beatles. When she got out, you know, youth culture had happened, and she was still this woman used to... Vatican II happened right at the end of her time in the convent, and... It's an amazing book, and she is an amazing woman. She's actually a very important religious scholar, writes a lot about Islam, and her books are getting a lot of attention. But if I am convinced that people who have had similar experiences with religion, that certain things stay true no matter what religion it is. But we live in a very secular society, and war is hell. You know, people can say that, and it makes sense. But if you say hell is hell, that's a tautology. It doesn't make sense to anybody. I mean, damnation is not a popular topic these days, and that's what I write about. I was writing about damnation. So who wants to read about that? Plus, there wasn't very much sex. So I'm sure that all those New York agents were going, well, you know... Where are the juicy bits? So, Hugo.
I will make it easy for you. I love the stuff you read. You write. I read. I have read for years the poetry that you have published in Dialogue. When I went on my mission, I was going outside the country. I was going to live in a foreign country for the first time in my life. I was so excited. I think the idea of adventure was one of the guiding ideas that I was following, and I lived my mission as if it were an adventure, and I wrote about it as if it were an adventure. Do you think that men and women go on missions with different expectations?
Thought about that. Do I think that men and women go on missions with different expectations? I have never thought about that. I am sure they do, actually. I think it's harder just since women have the option of going and aren't expected to go. I'm sure that makes a difference. They're older. leadership is less of an issue. Plus, women have to put up with 19-year-old elders telling them what to do. I went on my mission expecting to have a lot of time to think and study and meditate and to figure out answers to questions. And I did have some time for that, but not nearly as much as I hoped or imagined. I thought I'd walk around and talk to people about God and we'd all be edified all the time. So I want to comment on a few things that Karen said, a few points she raised. This issue of imagination and losing your imagination. I was actually talking to a friend of mine who is a doctor about that after I got home from my mission and explaining about how I felt I had lost my ability to make metaphor. And he said that that's actually a symptom of profound depression. That if you ask, you know, you can ask someone with a PhD, what does it mean? Explain this to me. People who live in glass houses shouldn't throw rocks. And they'll say, well, you know, if you live in a glass house and you go around throwing rocks, one could hit your house. Or what does it mean? No use crying over spilled milk. And they'll say, well, if the milk's on the floor, you can't drink it. They have they see things absolutely literally. They lose the ability to make metaphor. And so what I was complaining about is something that happens to people experiencing a breakdown of their world. And it wasn't just me. Unfortunately, you know, I was in a foreign country. I did eventually get psychiatric help. I ended up getting my first prescription for antidepressants from a trio of Chinese atheist Freudian psychiatrists who spoke to me only in Chinese and only wanted to ask about my sex life, which, you know, I was a 22-year-old Mormon virgin missionary. I didn't have much to tell them. But the fact that I was so isolated and had so little access to people who would understand my condition exacerbated everything. The only thing that made it okay was that I did have a really cool mission president and some really good friends. So, yes, in the first row. Well, I intended to twice. I intended to twice. One was gay, and he's still my best friend. He lives in Brussels. I just went to see him. The other was just a jerk. He changed his mind. So I don't, you know. It's not a decision that's entirely up to me. So, yes.
Two questions, one for you and then one for Karen. One for you is, when did you get your imagination back?
I feel like my imagination is still impaired. Yes, but I feel like it's. I did, you know, get a PhD, which is the other thing that will kill your imagination. You know, I'm still very literal. And when I got my PhD, I did 20th century American literary nonfiction, partly because of my Mormon background. You know, we write journals, we write life stories, and nonfiction was a genre that made intuitive sense to me. My imagination, it's not where it could be. I don't know what I'd have to do to get it back. Anyway.
It's not a long answer. I never really wanted to go on a full-time mission, and I don't have any regrets about not doing it. It would have interfered with too many of the things that I've done that I've loved doing, including things like travel to Australia and teach there.
Anyone else? Chris?
Have you replaced Mormonism with anything religious
and
spiritual
lines? Not anything official and not anything in particular. Karen mentioned that the only one of her friends who had replaced Mormonism was something official had chosen Buddhism. I gravitate to Buddhism too for a lot of reasons. And the January issue of Sunstone has a later chapter from this book that talks about how I came to, talks about some of my official introduction to Buddhism. I do like Buddhism a lot. I like yoga a lot, and I feel that it's a very, I mean, there's a reason why it's 3,500 years old and still has all these practitioners. It does do a lot of cool things. I'm kind of your basic, you know, eclectic New Age person who steals from any tradition that seems to offer something meaningful. I talk with several of my friends about the fact that we, having left the church, we still find it really terrifying to consider officially joining anything else. I think I don't think I ever will. It just
hurts your imagination.
Well, no, it just, it's, you know, Mormonism to me was meaningful because it was a community that I, the community I cared about most deeply. So if I managed to leave that, if I managed to, you know, my family joined the church in 1832. I have polygamists in every branch of my family. All my extended family's Mormon except for a few cousins. You know, I mean, I grew up in a town so Mormon, we had our high school prom in the cultural hall. If I could leave that community, you know, just joining some other, you know, officially becoming Episcopalian, I'm sorry, but that's not going to cut it. It's just not. So. Detach. Don't become too attached to any beliefs, to any possessions, to your idea of the world, because if it ever goes wrong for you, you will remain invested in a broken system, because your attachment means more to you than the truth. No. No. They don't. They and for that can I refer you once again to Karen Armstrong, A History of God by Karen Armstrong. It's, I don't know, 10 years old or so. She mostly talks about monotheism, but her discussion of the divine is really, really interesting. She does, you know, she's talking about mainly Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, but when she does bring in Buddhism to contrast it with the monotheistic religions, she makes it very understandable, and it's just such an amazing book. It's really, she's great. Yes?
Well,
Wallace Stevens says it's the imagination, and I think he's right. She said, what would I say is the magnificent cause of being? And I said, well, Wallace Stevens says it's the imagination. I'll read this again. The magnificent cause of being, the imagination, the one reality in this imagined world leaves you. That's from a poem called Another Weeping Woman. You know, I mean, the Buddhists would say that the magnificent cause of being is consciousness. So I don't think that the imagination is necessarily all that different from consciousness in the Buddhist sense. So I think that is a fair answer.